"Don't be afraid," said Pierre in answer to a frightened gesture of Anatole's. "First, the letters," said he, as if repeating a lesson to himself. "Secondly," he continued after a short pause, again rising and again pacing the room, "tomorrow you must get out of Moscow." "But how can I?" "Thirdly," Pierre continued without listening to him, "you must never breathe a word of what has passed between you and Countess Rostova. I know I can't prevent your doing so, but if you have a spark of conscience..." Pierre paced the room several times in silence. Anatole sat at a table, frowning and biting his lips. "After all, you must understand that besides your pleasure, there is such a thing as other people's happiness and peace, and that you are ruining a whole life for the sake of amusing yourself. Amuse yourself with women like my wife. With them you are within your rights, for they know what you want of them. They are armed against you by the same experience of debauchery. But to promise a maid to marry her, to deceive, to kidnap... Don't you understand that it is as mean as beating an old man or a child?" Pierre paused and looked at Anatole, no longer with an angry but with a questioning look.
"I don't know about that, eh?"
said Anatole, growing more confident as Pierre mastered his wrath. "I don't know that, and I don't want to," he said, not looking at Pierre, and with a slight tremor of his lower jaw. "But you have used such words to me, mean and so on, which as a man of honour I can't allow anyone to use." Pierre glanced at him with amazement, unable to understand what he wanted.
"Though it was a tete-a-tete," Anatole continued, "still I can't..."
"Is it satisfaction you want?" said Pierre ironically.
"You could at least take back your words, what? If you want me to do as you wish, eh?"
"I take them back. I take them back," said Pierre, "and I ask you to forgive me." Pierre involuntarily glanced at the loose button. "And if you require money for your journey..." Anatole smiled. The expression of that base and cringing smile which Pierre knew so well in his wife revolted him. "Oh, vile and heartless brood," he exclaimed, and left the room. Next day, Anatole left for Petersburg. Chapter 21. Prince Andrei returns to Moscow. Pierre drove to Maria Dmitrievna's to tell her of the fulfillment of her wish that Kuragin should be banished from Moscow. The whole house was in a state of alarm and commotion. Natasha was very ill, having, as Maria Dmitrievna told him in secret, poisoned herself the night after she had been told that Anatole was married, with some arsenic she had stealthily procured. After swallowing a little, she had been so frightened that she woke Sonia and told her what she had done. The necessary antidotes had been administered in time, and she was now out of danger, though still so weak that it was out of the question to move her to the country, and so the Countess had been sent for. Pierre saw the distracted Count and Sonia, who had a tear-stained face, but he could not see Natasha. Pierre dined at the club that day and heard on all sides gossip about the attempted abduction of Rostova. He resolutely denied these rumours, assuring everyone that nothing had happened except that his brother-in-law had proposed to her and been refused. It seemed to Pierre that it was his duty to conceal the whole affair and re-establish Natasha's reputation. He was awaiting Prince Andrei's return with dread and went every day to the old prince's for news of him. Old Prince Bolkonski heard all the rumours current in the town from Mademoiselle Bourienne and had read the note to Princess Maria in which Natasha had broken off her engagement. He seemed in better spirits than usual and awaited his son with great impatience. Some days after Anatole's departure, Pierre received a note from Prince Andrei informing him of his arrival and asking him to come to see him. As soon as he reached Moscow, Prince Andrei had received from his father Natasha's note to Princess Maria breaking off her engagement. Mademoiselle Bourienne had purloined it from Princess Maria and given it to the old prince, and he heard from him the story of Natasha's elopement, with additions. Prince Andrei had arrived in the evening, and Pierre came to see him next morning. Pierre expected to find Prince Andrei in almost the same state as Natasha, and was therefore surprised on entering the drawing-room to hear him in the study talking in a loud, animated voice about some intrigue going on in Petersburg. The old prince's voice and another now and then interrupted him. Princess Maria came out to meet Pierre. She sighed, looking toward the door of the room where Prince Andrei was, evidently intending to express her sympathy with his sorrow, but Pierre saw by her face that she was glad both at what had happened and at the way her brother had taken the news of Natasha's faithlessness.
"He says he expected it," she remarked. "I know his pride will not let him express his feelings, but still he has taken it better, far better than I expected. Evidently it had to be."
"But is it possible that all is really ended?" asked Pierre.
Princess Maria looked at him with astonishment. She did not understand how he could ask such a question. Pierre went into the study. Prince Andrei, greatly changed and plainly in better health, but with a fresh horizontal wrinkle between his brows, stood in civilian dress facing his father and Prince Meshchersky, warmly disputing and vigorously gesticulating. The conversation was about Speransky, the news of whose sudden exile and alleged treachery had just reached Moscow.
"Now he is censured and accused by all who were enthusiastic about him a month ago," Prince Andrei was saying, "and by those who were unable to understand his aims. To judge a man who is in disfavour and to throw on him all the blame of other men's mistakes is very easy, but I maintain that if anything good has been accomplished in this reign, it was done by him alone."
He paused at the sight of Pierre. His face quivered and immediately assumed a vindictive expression.
"Posterity will do him justice," he concluded, and at once turned to Pierre. "Well, how are you? Still getting stouter?" he said with animation, but the new wrinkle on his forehead deepened. "Yes, I am well," he said in answer to Pierre's question, and smiled. To Pierre that smile said plainly, "I am well, but my health is now of no use to anyone." After a few words to Pierre about the awful roads from the Polish frontier, about people he had met in Switzerland who knew Pierre, and about Monsieur Dessalles, whom he had brought from abroad to be his son's tutor, Prince Andrei again joined warmly in the conversation about Speransky, which was still going on between the two old men.
"If there were treason or proofs of secret relations with Napoleon, they would have been made public," he said with warmth and haste. "I do not and never did like Speransky personally, but I like justice."
Pierre now recognized in his friend a need with which he was only too familiar, to get excited and to have arguments about extraneous matters in order to stifle thoughts that were too oppressive and too intimate. When Prince Meshchersky had left, Prince Andrei took Pierre's arm and asked him into the room that had been assigned him. A bed had been made up there, and some open portmanteaus and trunks stood about. Prince Andrei went to one and took out a small casket, from which he drew a packet wrapped in paper. He did it all silently and very quickly. He stood up and coughed. His face was gloomy and his lips compressed.
"Forgive me for troubling you."
Pierre saw that Prince Andrei was going to speak of Natasha, and his broad face expressed pity and sympathy. This expression irritated Prince Andrei, and in a determined, ringing, and unpleasant tone he continued,
"I have received a refusal from Countess Rostova, and have heard reports of your brother-in-law having sought her hand, or something of that kind. Is that true?"
"Both true and untrue," Pierre began, but Prince Andrei interrupted him.
"Here are her letters and her portrait," said he.
He took the packet from the table and handed it to Pierre.
"Give this to the Countess, if you see her."
"She is very ill," said Pierre.
"Then she is still here," said Prince Andrei. "And Prince Kuragin?" he added quickly.
"He left long ago. She has been at death's door."
"I much regret her illness," said Prince Andrei, and he smiled like his father, coldly, maliciously, and unpleasantly. "So Monsieur Kuragin has not honoured Countess Rostova with his hand," said Prince Andrei, and he snorted several times.
"He could not marry, for he was married already, said Pierre.
Prince Andrei laughed disagreeably, again reminding one of his father.
And where is your brother-in-law now, if I may ask? He said.
He has gone to Peter's... But I don't know, said Pierre.
Well, it doesn't matter, said Prince Andrei. Tell Countess Rostova that she was and is perfectly free, and that I wish her all that is good.
Pierre took the packet. Prince Andrei, as if trying to remember whether he had something more to say, or waiting to see if Pierre would say anything, looked fixedly at him.
I say, do you remember our discussion in Petersburg? Asked Pierre. About...
Yes, returned Prince Andrei hastily.
I said that a fallen woman should be forgiven, but I didn't say I could forgive her.
I can't.
But this can't be compared, said Pierre.
Prince Andrei interrupted him and cried sharply,
Yes, ask her hand again. Be magnanimous and so on. Yes, that would be very noble, but I am unable to follow in that gentleman's footsteps. If you wish to be my friend, never speak to me of that, of all that.
Well, goodbye. So you'll give her the packet? Pierre left the room and went to the old prince and Princess Maria.
The old man seemed livelier than usual. Princess Maria was the same as always, but beneath her sympathy for her brother, Pierre noticed her satisfaction that the engagement had been broken off. Looking at them, Pierre realized what contempt and animosity they all felt for the Rostovs, and that it was impossible in their presence even to mention the name of her who could give up Prince Andrei for anyone else. At dinner the talk turned on the war, the approach of which was becoming evident. Prince Andrei talked incessantly, arguing now with his father, now with the Swiss tutor, Dessalles, and showing an unnatural animation, the cause of which Pierre so well understood.
Chapter 22. Pierre and Natasha. That same evening Pierre went to the Rostovs to fulfil the commission entrusted to him. Natasha was in bed, the count at the club, and Pierre, after giving the letters to Sonia, went to Maria Dmitrievna, who was interested to know how Prince Andrei had taken the news. 10 minutes later, Sonia came to Maria Dmitrievna.
Natasha insists on seeing Count Pierre, said she.
But how? Are we to take him up to her? The room there has not been tidied up.
No, she has dressed and gone into the drawing room, said Sonia.
Maria Dmitrievna only shrugged her shoulders.
When will her mother come? She has worried me to death. Now mind, don't tell her everything, said she to Pierre. One hasn't the heart to scold her. She is so much to be pitied, so much to be pitied.
Natasha was standing in the middle of the drawing room, emaciated, with a pale, set face, but not at all shamefaced, as Pierre expected to find her. When he appeared at the door, she grew flurried, evidently undecided whether to go to meet him or to wait till he came up. Pierre hastened to her. He thought she would give him her hand as usual, but she, stepping up to him, stopped, breathing heavily, her arms hanging lifelessly, just in the pose she used to stand in when she went to the middle of the ballroom to sing, but with quite a different expression of face.
"Pyotr Kirillovich," she began rapidly. "Prince Bolkonski was your friend, is your friend," she corrected herself.
It seemed to her that everything that had once been must now be different.
"He told me once to apply to you."
Pierre sniffed as he looked at her, but did not speak. Till then he had reproached her in his heart and tried to despise her, but he now felt so sorry for her that there was no room in his soul for reproach.
"He is here now. Tell him to forgive me."
She stopped and breathed still more quickly, but did not shed tears.
"Yes, I will tell him," answered Pierre, but he did not know what to say.
Natasha was evidently dismayed at the thought of what he might think she had meant.
"No, I know all is over," she said hurriedly. "No, that can never be. I'm only tormented by the wrong I have done him. Tell him only that I beg him to forgive me for everything."
She trembled all over and sat down on a chair.
A sense of pity he had never before known overflowed Pierre's heart.
"I will tell him. I will tell him everything once more," said Pierre. "But I should like to know one thing."
"Know what?" Natasha's eyes asked.
"I should like to know, did you love..."
Pierre did not know how to refer to Anatole and flushed at the thought of him.
"Did you love that bad man?"
"Don't call him bad," said Natasha. "But I don't know. Don't know at all."
She began to cry, and a still greater sense of pity, tenderness, and love welled up in Pierre. He felt the tears trickle under his spectacles and hoped they would not be noticed.
"We won't speak of it any more, my dear," said Pierre, and his gentle, cordial tone suddenly seemed very strange to Natasha. "We won't speak of it, my dear. I'll tell him everything. But one thing I beg of you, consider me your friend. And if you want help, advice, or simply to open your heart to someone, not now, but when your mind is clearer, think of me."
He took her hand and kissed it.
"I shall be happy if it's in my power."
Pierre grew confused.
"No, don't speak to me like that. I am not worth it," exclaimed Natasha and turned to leave the room.
But Pierre held her hand. He knew he had something more to say to her, but when he said it, he was amazed at his own words.
"Stop, stop! You have your whole life before you," said he to her.
"Before me? No. All is over for me," she replied with shame and self-abasement.
"All over?" he repeated. "If I were not myself, but the handsomest, cleverest, and best man in the world, and were free, I would this moment ask on my knees for your hand and your love."
For the first time for many days, Natasha wept tears of gratitude and tenderness, and glancing at Pierre, she went out of the room. Pierre, too, when she had gone, almost ran into the anteroom, restraining tears of tenderness and joy that choked him, and without finding the sleeves of his fur cloak, threw it on and got into his sleigh.
"Where to now, Your Excellency?" asked the coachman.
"Where to?" Pierre asked himself. "Where can I go now? Surely not to the club or to pay calls."
All men seemed so pitiful, so poor, in comparison with this feeling of tenderness and love he experienced, in comparison with that softened, grateful last look she had given him through her tears.
"Home," said Pierre, and despite 22 degrees of frost Fahrenheit, he threw open the bearskin cloak from his broad chest and inhaled the air with joy.
It was clear and frosty. Above the dirty, ill-lit streets, above the black roofs, stretched the dark, starry sky. Only looking up at the sky did Pierre cease to feel how sordid and humiliating were all mundane things compared with the heights to which his soul had just been raised. At the entrance to the Arbat Square, an immense expanse of dark, starry sky presented itself to his eyes. Almost in the centre of it, above the Prechistenka Boulevard, surrounded and sprinkled on all sides by stars, but distinguished from them all by its nearness to the earth, its white light and its long, uplifted tail, shone the enormous and brilliant comet of 1812, the comet which was said to portend all kinds of woes and the end of the world. In Pierre, however, that comet with its long, luminous tail aroused no feeling of fear. On the contrary, he gazed joyfully, his eyes moist with tears, at this bright comet, which, having travelled in its orbit with inconceivable velocity through immeasurable space, seemed suddenly, like an arrow piercing the earth, to remain fixed in a chosen spot, vigorously holding its tail erect, shining and displaying its white light amid countless other scintillating stars. It seemed to Pierre that this comet fully responded to what was passing in his own softened and uplifted soul, now blossoming into a new life.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Book 9, 1812. Chapter 1. Rulers and generals are history's slaves. From the close of the year 1811, intensified arming and concentrating of the forces of Western Europe began. And in 1812, these forces, millions of men, reckoning those transporting and feeding the army, moved from the west eastwards to the Russian frontier, toward which, since 1811, Russian forces had been similarly drawn. On the 12th of June 1812, the forces of Western Europe crossed the Russian frontier, and war began. That is, an event took place opposed to human reason and to human nature. Millions of men perpetrated against one another such innumerable crimes, frauds, treacheries, thefts, forgeries, issues of false money, burglaries, incendiarisms, and murders as in whole centuries are not recorded in the annals of all the law courts of the world, but which those who committed them did not at the time regard as being crimes. What produced this extraordinary occurrence? What were its causes? The historians tell us with naive assurance that its causes were the wrongs inflicted on the Duke of Oldenburg, the non-observance of the continental system, the ambition of Napoleon, the firmness of Alexander, the mistakes of the diplomatists, and so on. Consequently, it would only have been necessary for Metternich, Rumyantsev, or Talleyrand, between a levée and an evening party, to have taken proper pains and written a more adroit note, or for Napoleon to have written to Alexander, "My respected brother, I consent to restore the duchy to the Duke of Oldenburg," and there would have been no war. We can understand that the matter seemed like that to contemporaries. It naturally seemed to Napoleon that the war was caused by England's intrigues, as in fact he said on the island of St. Helena. It naturally seemed to members of the English Parliament that the cause of the war was Napoleon's ambition, to the Duke of Oldenburg that the cause of the war was the violence done to him, to businessmen that the cause of the war was the continental system which was ruining Europe, to the generals and old soldiers, that the chief reason for the war was the necessity of giving them employment, to the legitimists of that day, that it was the need of re-establishing les bons principes, and to the diplomatists of that time, that it all resulted from the fact that the alliance between Russia and Austria in 1809 had not been sufficiently well concealed from Napoleon, and from the awkward wording of Memorandum No. 178. It is natural that these and a countless and infinite quantity of other reasons, the number depending on the endless diversity of points of view, presented themselves to the men of that day. But to us, to posterity, who view the thing that happened in all its magnitude and perceive its plain and terrible meaning, these causes seem insufficient. To us it is incomprehensible that millions of Christian men killed and tortured each other, either because Napoleon was ambitious or Alexander was firm, or because England's policy was astute or the Duke of Oldenburg wronged. We cannot grasp what connection such circumstances have with the actual fact of slaughter and violence. Why, because the Duke was wronged, thousands of men from the other side of Europe killed and ruined the people of Smolensk and Moscow and were killed by them. To us, their descendants, who are not historians and are not carried away by the process of research and can therefore regard the event with unclouded common sense, an incalculable number of causes present themselves. The deeper we delve in search of these causes, the more of them we find, and each separate cause or whole series of causes appears to us equally valid in itself and equally false by its insignificance compared to the magnitude of the events and by its impotence, apart from the cooperation of all the other coincident causes, to occasion the event. To us, the wish or objection of this or that French corporal to serve a second term appears as much a cause as Napoleon's refusal to withdraw his troops beyond the Vistula and to restore the Duchy of Oldenburg. For had he not wished to serve, and had a second, a third, and a thousandth corporal and private also refused, there would have been so many less men in Napoleon's army, and the war could not have occurred. Had Napoleon not taken offence at that demand that he should withdraw beyond the Vistula, and not ordered his troops to advance, there would have been no war. But had all his sergeants subjected to serving a second term, then also there could have been no war. Nor could there have been a war had there been no English intrigues and no Duke of Oldenburg, and had Alexander not felt insulted, and had there not been an autocratic government in Russia, or a revolution in France, and a subsequent dictatorship and empire, or all the things that produced the French Revolution, and so on. Without each of these causes, nothing could have happened. So all these causes, myriads of causes, coincided to bring it about. And so there was no one cause for that occurrence, but it had to occur, because it had to. Millions of men, renouncing their human feelings and reason, had to go from west to east to slay their fellows, just as some centuries previously hordes of men had come from the east to the west, slaying their fellows. The actions of Napoleon and Alexander, on whose words the event seemed to hang, were as little voluntary as the actions of any soldier who was drawn into the campaign by lot or by conscription. This could not be otherwise, for in order that the will of Napoleon and Alexander, on whom the event seemed to depend, should be carried out, the concurrence of innumerable circumstances was needed, without any one of which the event could not have taken place. It was necessary that millions of men in whose hands lay the real power, the soldiers who fired or transported provisions and guns, should consent to carry out the will of these weak individuals, and should have been induced to do so by an infinite number of diverse and complex causes. We are forced to fall back on fatalism as an explanation of irrational events, that is to say, events the reasonableness of which we do not understand. The more we try to explain such events in history reasonably, the more unreasonable and incomprehensible do they become to us. Each man lives for himself, using his freedom to attain his personal aims, and feels with his whole being that he can now do or abstain from doing this or that action. But as soon as he has done it, that action performed at a certain moment in time becomes irrevocable and belongs to history, in which it has not a free but a predestined significance. There are two sides to the life of every man. His individual life, which is the more free, the more abstract its interests, and his elemental hive life, in which he inevitably obeys laws laid down for him. Man lives consciously for himself, but is an unconscious instrument in the attainment of the historic, universal aims of humanity. A deed done is irrevocable, and its result, coinciding in time with the actions of millions of other men, assumes an historic significance. The higher a man stands on the social ladder, the more people he is connected with and the more power he has over others, the more evident is the predestination and inevitability of his every action. The king's heart is in the hands of the Lord. A king is history's slave. History, that is, the unconscious, general hive life of mankind, uses every moment of the life of kings as a tool for its own purposes. Though Napoleon at that time in 1812 was more convinced than ever that it depended on him, verser ou ne pas verser le sang de ses peuples, to shed or not to shed the blood of his peoples, as Alexander expressed it in the last letter he wrote him, he had never been so much in the grip of inevitable laws, which compelled him, while thinking that he was acting on his own volition, to perform for the hive life, that is to say, for history, whatever had to be performed. The people of the West moved eastward to slay their fellow men, and by the law of coincidence, thousands of minute causes fitted in and coordinated to produce that movement and war. Reproaches for the non-observance of the continental system, the Duke of Oldenburg's wrongs, the movement of troops into Prussia, undertaken, as it seemed to Napoleon, only for the purpose of securing an armed peace, the French Emperor's love and habit of war coinciding with his people's inclinations, allurement by the grandeur of the preparations, and the expenditure on those preparations, and the need of obtaining advantages to compensate for that expenditure, the intoxicating honours he received in Dresden, the diplomatic negotiations which, in the opinion of contemporaries, were carried on with a sincere desire to attain peace, but which only wounded the self-love of both sides, and millions of other causes that adapted themselves to the event that was happening or coincided with it. When an apple has ripened and falls, why does it fall? Because of its attraction to the earth? Because its stalk withers? Because it is dried by the sun? Because it grows heavier? Because the wind shakes it? Or because the boy standing below wants to eat it? Nothing is the cause. All this is only the coincidence of conditions in which all vital, organic, and elemental events occur. And the botanist who finds that the apple falls because the cellular tissue decays and so forth is equally right with the child who stands under the tree and says the apple fell because he wanted to eat it and prayed for it. Equally right or wrong is he who says that Napoleon went to Moscow because he wanted to and perished because Alexander desired his destruction, and he who says that an undermined hill, weighing a million tons, fell because the last navvy struck it for the last time with his mattock. In historic events, the so-called great men are labels giving names to events, and like labels, they have but the smallest connection with the event itself. Every act of theirs, which appears to them an act of their own will, is in an historical sense involuntary, and is related to the whole course of history and predestined from eternity. Chapter 2. Napoleon Crosses the Niemen. On the 29th of May, Napoleon left Dresden, where he had spent 3 weeks, surrounded by a court that included princes, dukes, kings, and even an emperor. Before leaving, Napoleon showed favour to the emperor, kings, and princes who had deserved it, reprimanded the kings and princes with whom he was dissatisfied, presented pearls and diamonds of his own, that is, which he had taken from other kings, to the Empress of Austria, and having, as his historian tells us, tenderly embraced the Empress Marie-Louise, who regarded him as her husband, though he had left another wife in Paris, left her grieved by the parting, which she seemed hardly able to bear. Though the diplomatists still firmly believed in the possibility of peace, and worked zealously to that end, and though the Emperor Napoleon himself wrote a letter to Alexander, calling him Monsieur mon frère, and sincerely assured him that he did not want war, and would always love and honour him, yet he set off to join his army, and at every station gave fresh orders to accelerate the movement of his troops from west to east. He went in a travelling coach with 6 horses, surrounded by pages, aides-de-camp, and an escort along the road to Posen, Thorn, Danzig, and Königsberg. At each of these towns, thousands of people met him with excitement and enthusiasm. The army was moving from west to east, and relays of 6 horses carried him in the same direction. On the 10th of June, coming up with the army, he spent the night in apartments prepared for him on the estate of a Polish count in the Wilkowiski forest. Next day, overtaking the army, he went in a carriage to the Niemen, and changing into a Polish uniform, he drove to the riverbank in order to select a place for the crossing. Seeing on the other side some Cossacks, les Cosaques, and the wide-spreading steppes, in the midst of which lay the holy city of Moscow, Moscou, la ville sainte, the capital of a realm such as the Scythia into which Alexander the Great had marched, Napoleon unexpectedly, and contrary alike to strategic and diplomatic considerations, ordered an advance, and the next day his army began to cross the Niemen. Early in the morning of the 12th of June he came out of his tent, which was pitched that day on the steep left bank of the Niemen, and looked through a spyglass at the streams of his troops pouring out of the Wilkowiski forest and flowing over the 3 bridges thrown across the river. The troops, knowing of the Emperor's presence, were on the lookout for him, and when they caught sight of a figure in an overcoat and a cocked hat standing apart from his suite in front of his tent on the hill, they threw up their caps and shouted, "Vive l'Empereur!" and one after another poured in a ceaseless stream out of the vast forest that had concealed them, and separating, flowed on and on by the 3 bridges to the other side. "Now we'll go into action. Oh, when he takes it in hand himself, things get hot, by heaven. There he is! Vive l'Empereur!
So these are the steppes of Asia. It's a nasty country all the same.
Au revoir, Boche. I'll keep the best palace in Moscow for you. Au revoir.
Good luck. Did you see the Emperor? Vive l'Empereur! Empereur! If they make me Governor of India, Gerard, I'll make you Minister of Kashmir. That's settled. Vive l'Empereur! Hurrah! 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 The Cossacks, those rascals. See how they run. Vive l'Empereur! There he is. Do you see him? I've seen him twice as I see you now. The little corporal. I saw him give the cross to one of the veterans. Vive l'Empereur! Came the voices of men, old and young, of most diverse characters and social positions. On the faces of all was one common expression of joy at the commencement of the long-expected campaign, and of rapture and devotion to the man in the grey coat who was standing on the hill.
On the 13th of June, a rather small thoroughbred Arab horse was brought to Napoleon. He mounted it and rode at a gallop to one of the bridges over the Niemen, deafened continually by incessant and rapturous acclamations, which he evidently endured only because it was impossible to forbid the soldiers to express their love of him by such shouting. But the shouting which accompanied him everywhere disturbed him and distracted him from the military cares that had occupied him from the time he joined the army. He rode across one of the swaying pontoon bridges to the farther side, turned sharply to the left, and galloped in the direction of Kovno, preceded by enraptured mounted chasseurs of the guard, who, breathless with delight, galloped ahead to clear a path for him through the troops. On reaching the broad river Vilia, he stopped near a regiment of Polish Uhlans stationed by the river.
"Vivat!"
shouted the Poles ecstatically, breaking their ranks and pressing against one another to see him. Napoleon looked up and down the river, dismounted, and sat down on a log that lay on the bank. At a mute sign from him, a telescope was handed him, which he rested on the back of a happy page who had run up to him, and he gazed at the opposite bank. Then he became absorbed in a map laid out on the logs. Without lifting his head, he said something, and two of his aides-de-camp galloped off to the Polish Uhlans.
"What? What did he say?"
was heard in the ranks of the Polish Uhlans when one of the aides-de-camp rode up to them. The order was to find a ford and to cross the river. The colonel of the Polish Uhlans, a handsome old man, flushed and, fumbling in his speech from excitement, asked the aide-de-camp whether he would be permitted to swim the river with his Uhlans instead of seeking a ford. In evident fear of refusal, like a boy asking for permission to get on a horse, he begged to be allowed to swim across the river before the emperor's eyes. The aide-de-camp replied that probably the emperor would not be displeased at this excess of zeal. As soon as the aide-de-camp had said this, the old moustached officer, with happy face and sparkling eyes, raised his sabre, shouted, "Vivat!" and, commanding the Uhlans to follow him, spurred his horse and galloped into the river. He gave an angry thrust to his horse, which had grown restive under him, and plunged into the water, heading for the deepest part where the current was swift. Hundreds of Uhlans galloped in after him. It was cold and uncanny in the rapid current in the middle of the stream, and the Uhlans caught hold of one another as they fell off their horses. Some of the horses were drowned, and some of the men. The others tried to swim on, some in the saddle and some clinging to their horses' manes. They tried to make their way forward to the opposite bank, and though there was a ford one-third of a mile away, were proud that they were swimming and drowning in this river under the eyes of the man who sat on the log and was not even looking at what they were doing. When the aide-de-camp, having returned and choosing an opportune moment, ventured to draw the emperor's attention to the devotion of the Poles to his person, the little man in the grey overcoat got up and, having summoned Berthier, began pacing up and down the bank with him, giving him instructions and occasionally glancing disapprovingly at the drowning Uhlans who distracted his attention. For him, it was no new conviction that his presence in any part of the world, from Africa to the steppes of Muscovy alike, was enough to dumbfound people and impel them to insane self-oblivion. He called for his horse and rode to his quarters. Some 40 Uhlans were drowned in the river, though boats were sent to their assistance. The majority struggled back to the bank from which they had started. The colonel and some of his men got across, and with difficulty clambered out on the further bank. And as soon as they had got out, in their soaked and streaming clothes, they shouted, "Vivat!" and looked ecstatically at the spot where Napoleon had been, but where he no longer was, and at that moment considered themselves happy. That evening, between issuing one order that the forged Russian paper money prepared for use in Russia should be delivered as quickly as possible, and another that a Saxon should be shot, on whom a letter containing information about the orders to the French army had been found, Napoleon also gave instructions that the Polish colonel, who had needlessly plunged into the river, should be enrolled in the Légion d'honneur, of which Napoleon was himself the head. Quos vult perdere dementat. Those whom God wishes to destroy, he drives mad. Chapter 3. Alexander I at Vilna. The Emperor of Russia had, meanwhile, been in Vilna for more than a month, reviewing troops and holding manoeuvres. Nothing was ready for the war that everyone expected, and to prepare for which the Emperor had come from Petersburg. There was no general plan of action. The vacillation between the various plans that were proposed had even increased after the Emperor had been at headquarters for a month. Each of the three armies had its own commander-in-chief, but there was no supreme commander of all the forces, and the Emperor did not assume that responsibility himself. The longer the Emperor remained in Vilna, the less did everybody, tired of waiting, prepare for the war. All the efforts of those who surrounded the sovereign seemed directed merely to making him spend his time pleasantly and forget that war was impending. In June, after many balls and fêtes given by the Polish magnates, by the courtiers, and by the Emperor himself, it occurred to one of the Polish aides-de-camp in attendance that a dinner and ball should be given for the Emperor by his aides-de-camp. This idea was eagerly received. The Emperor gave his consent. The aides-de-camp collected money by subscription. The lady who was thought to be most pleasing to the Emperor was invited to act as hostess. Count Bennigsen, being a landowner in the Vilna province, offered his country house for the fête, and the 13th of June was fixed for a ball, dinner, regatta, and fireworks at Zakret, Count Bennigsen's country seat. The very day that Napoleon issued the order to cross the Niemen, and his vanguard, driving off the Cossacks, crossed the Russian frontier, Alexander spent the evening at the entertainment given by his aides-de-camp at Bennigsen's country house. It was a gay and brilliant fête. Connoisseurs of such matters declared that rarely had so many beautiful women been assembled in one place. Countess Bezukhova was present among other Russian ladies who had followed the sovereign from Petersburg to Vilna and eclipsed the refined Polish ladies by her massive, so-called Russian type of beauty. The Emperor noticed her and honoured her with a dance. Boris Drubetskoy, having left his wife in Moscow and being for the present en garçon, as he phrased it, was also there, and though not an aide-de-camp, had subscribed a large sum towards the expenses. Boris was now a rich man who had risen to high honours and no longer sought patronage, but stood on an equal footing with the highest of those of his own age. He was meeting Hélène in Vilna after not having seen her for a long time, and did not recall the past. But as Hélène was enjoying the favours of a very important personage, and Boris had only recently married, they met as good friends of long standing. At midnight, dancing was still going on. Hélène, not having a suitable partner, herself offered to dance the mazurka with Boris. They were the third couple. Boris, coolly looking at Hélène's dazzling bare shoulders, which emerged from a dark, gold-embroidered gauze gown, talked to her of old acquaintances and at the same time, unaware of it himself and unnoticed by others, never for an instant ceased to observe the Emperor who was in the same room. The Emperor was not dancing. He stood in the doorway, stopping now one pair and now another with gracious words which he alone knew how to utter. As the mazurka began, Boris saw that Adjutant General Balashyov, one of those in closest attendance on the Emperor, went up to him, and contrary to court etiquette, stood near him while he was talking to a Polish lady. Having finished speaking to her, the Emperor looked inquiringly at Balashov, and evidently understanding that he only acted thus because there were important reasons for so doing, nodded slightly to the lady and turned to him. Hardly had Balashov begun to speak before a look of amazement appeared on the Emperor's face. He took Balashov by the arm and crossed the room with him, unconsciously clearing a path 7 yards wide as the people on both sides made way for him. Boris noticed Arakcheyev's excited face when the sovereign went out with Balashov. Arakcheyev looked at the Emperor from under his brow, and sniffing with his red nose, stepped forward from the crowd as if expecting the Emperor to address him. Boris understood that Arakcheyev envied Balashov, and was displeased that evidently important news had reached the Emperor otherwise than through himself. But the Emperor and Balashov passed out into the illuminated garden without noticing Arakcheyev, who, holding his sword and glancing wrathfully around, followed some 20 paces behind them. All the time Boris was going through the figures of the mazurka, he was worried by the question of what news Balashov had brought and how he could find it out before others. In the figure in which he had to choose 2 ladies, he whispered to Hélène that he meant to choose Countess Potocka, who he thought had gone out onto the veranda, and glided over the parquet to the door opening into the garden, where, seeing Balashov and the Emperor returning to the veranda, he stood still. They were moving toward the door. Boris, fluttering as if he had not had time to withdraw, respectfully pressed close to the doorpost with bowed head. The Emperor, with the agitation of one who has been personally affronted, was finishing with these words: "To enter Russia without declaring war? I will not make peace as long as a single armed enemy remains in my country." It seemed to Boris that it gave the Emperor pleasure to utter these words. He was satisfied with the form in which he had expressed his thoughts, but displeased that Boris had overheard it. "Let no one know of it," the Emperor added with a frown. Boris understood that this was meant for him, and closing his eyes, slightly bowed his head. The Emperor re-entered the ballroom and remained there about another half hour. Boris was thus the first to learn the news that the French army had crossed the Niemen, and thanks to this was able to show certain important personages that much that was concealed from others was usually known to him, and by this means he rose higher in their estimation. The unexpected news of the French having crossed the Niemen was particularly startling after a month of unfulfilled expectations and at a ball. On first receiving the news, under the influence of indignation and resentment, the Emperor had found a phrase that pleased him, fully expressed his feelings, and has since become famous. On returning home at 2 o'clock that night, he sent for his secretary, Shishkov, and told him to write an order to the troops and a rescript to Field Marshal Prince Saltykov, in which he insisted on the words being inserted that he would not make peace so long as a single armed Frenchman remained on Russian soil. Next day the following letter was sent to Napoleon. "Monsieur mon frère, yesterday I learnt that despite the loyalty with which I have kept my engagements with your Majesty, your troops have crossed the Russian frontier, and I have this moment received from Petersburg a note in which Count Lauriston informs me, as a reason for this aggression, that your Majesty has considered yourself to be in a state of war with me from the time Prince Kuragin asked for his passports. The reasons on which the Duc de Bassano based his refusal to deliver them to him would never have led me to suppose that that could serve as a pretext for aggression. In fact, the ambassador, as he himself has declared, was never authorized to make that demand, and as soon as I was informed of it, I let him know how much I disapproved of it and ordered him to remain at his post. If your Majesty does not intend to shed the blood of our peoples for such a misunderstanding, and consents to withdraw your troops from Russian territory, I will regard what has passed as not having occurred, and an understanding between us will be possible. In the contrary case, your Majesty, I shall see myself forced to repel an attack that nothing on my part has provoked. It still depends on your Majesty to preserve humanity from the calamity of another war. I am, etc. Signed, Alexander. Chapter 4. Balashov's Mission to Napoleon. At 2 in the morning of the 14th of June, the Emperor, having sent for Balashov and read him his letter to Napoleon, ordered him to take it and hand it personally to the French Emperor. When dispatching Balashov, the Emperor repeated to him the words that he would not make peace so long as a single armed enemy remained on Russian soil, and told him to transmit those words to Napoleon. Alexander did not insert them in his letter to Napoleon because, with his characteristic tact, he felt it would be injudicious to use them at a moment when a last attempt at reconciliation was being made, but he definitely instructed Balashov to repeat them personally to Napoleon. Having set off in the small hours of the 14th, accompanied by a bugler and 2 Cossacks, Balashov reached the French outposts at the village of Rikonti, on the Russian side of the Niemen, by dawn. There he was stopped by French cavalry sentinels. A French non-commissioned officer of hussars, in crimson uniform and a shaggy cap, shouted to the approaching Balashov to halt. Balashov did not do so at once, but continued to advance along the road at a walking pace. The non-commissioned officer frowned, and muttering words of abuse, advanced his horse's chest against Balashov, put his hand to his sabre, and shouted rudely at the Russian general, asking was he deaf that he did not do as he was told? Balashov mentioned who he was. The non-commissioned officer began talking with his comrades about regimental matters without looking at the Russian general. After living at the seat of the highest authority and power, after conversing with the Emperor less than 3 hours before, and in general being accustomed to the respect due to his rank in the service, Balashov found it very strange here on Russian soil to encounter this hostile, and still more this disrespectful, application of brute force to himself. The sun was only just appearing from behind the clouds. The air was fresh and dewy. A herd of cattle was being driven along the road from the village, and over the fields the larks rose trilling, one after another, like bubbles rising in water. Balashov looked around him, awaiting the arrival of an officer from the village. The Russian Cossacks and bugler and the French hussars looked silently at one another from time to time. A French colonel of hussars, who had evidently just left his bed, came riding from the village on a handsome, sleek, grey horse, accompanied by 2 hussars. The officer, the soldiers, and their horses all looked smart and well kept. It was that first period of a campaign when troops are still in full trim, almost like that of peacetime manoeuvres, but with a shade of martial swagger in their clothes, and a touch of the gaiety and spirit of enterprise which always accompany the opening of a campaign. The French colonel with difficulty repressed a yawn, but was polite and evidently understood Balashov's importance. He led him past his soldiers and behind the outposts, and told him that his wish to be presented to the Emperor would most likely be satisfied immediately, as the Emperor's quarters were, he believed, not far off. They rode through the village of Rikonti, past tethered French hussar horses, past sentinels and men who saluted their colonel and stared with curiosity at a Russian uniform, and came out at the other end of the village. The colonel said that the commander of the division was 1.25 miles away, and would receive Balashov and conduct him to his destination. The sun had by now risen and shone gaily on the bright verdure. They had hardly ridden up a hill, past a tavern, before they saw a group of horsemen coming toward them. In front of the group, on a black horse with trappings that glittered in the sun, rode a tall man with plumes in his hat and black hair curling down to his shoulders. He wore a red mantle and stretched his long legs forward in French fashion. This man rode toward Balashov at a gallop, his plumes flowing and his gems and gold lace glittering in the bright June sunshine. Balashov was only 2 horses' length from the equestrian with the bracelets, plumes, necklaces and gold embroidery, who was galloping toward him with a theatrically solemn countenance, when Julnare, the French colonel, whispered respectfully, "The King of Naples." It was, in fact, Murat, now called King of Naples, though it was quite incomprehensible why he should be King of Naples, he was called so, and was himself convinced that he was so, and therefore assumed a more solemn and important air than formerly. He was so sure that he really was the King of Naples that when, on the eve of his departure from that city, while walking through the streets with his wife, some Italians called out to him, "Viva il re!" he turned to his wife with a pensive smile and said, "Poor fellows, they don't know that I'm leaving them tomorrow." But though he firmly believed himself to be King of Naples, and pitied the grief felt by the subjects he was abandoning, latterly, after he had been ordered to return to military service, and especially since his last interview with Napoleon in Danzig, when his august brother-in-law had told him, "I made you king that you should reign in my way, but not in yours," he had cheerfully taken up his familiar business, and, like a well-fed but not over-fat horse that feels himself in harness and grows skittish between the shafts, he dressed up in clothes as variegated and expensive as possible, and gaily and contentedly galloped along the roads of Poland, without himself knowing why or whither. On seeing the Russian general, he threw back his head with its long hair curling to his shoulders in a majestically royal manner, and looked inquiringly at the French colonel. The colonel respectfully informed His Majesty of Balashov's mission, whose name he could not pronounce. "De Balmashev," said the king, overcoming by his assurance the difficulty that had presented itself to the colonel. "Charmed to make your acquaintance, general," he added, with a gesture of kingly condescension. As soon as the king began to speak loud and fast, his royal dignity instantly forsook him, and without noticing it, he passed into his natural tone of good-natured familiarity. He laid his hand on the withers of Balashov's horse and said, "Well, general, it all looks like war," as if regretting a circumstance of which he was unable to judge. "Your Majesty," replied Balashov, "my master the Emperor does not desire war, and as Your Majesty sees," said Balashov, using the words "Your Majesty" at every opportunity, with the affectation unavoidable in frequently addressing one to whom the title was still a novelty. Murat's face beamed with stupid satisfaction as he listened to Monsieur de Balmashev, but royauté oblige, and he felt it incumbent on him, as a king and an ally, to confer on state affairs with Alexander's envoy. He dismounted, took Balashov's arm, and moving a few steps away from his suite, which waited respectfully, began to pace up and down with him, trying to speak significantly. He referred to the fact that the Emperor Napoleon had resented the demand that he should withdraw his troops from Prussia, especially when that demand became generally known and the dignity of France was thereby offended. Balashov replied that there was nothing offensive in the demand because... But Murat interrupted him. "Then you don't consider the Emperor Alexander the aggressor?" he asked unexpectedly, with a kindly and foolish smile. Balashov told him why he considered Napoleon to be the originator of the war. "Oh, my dear general," Murat again interrupted him, "with all my heart I wish the emperors may arrange the affair between them, and that the war begun by no wish of mine may finish as quickly as possible," said he in the tone of a servant who wants to remain good friends with another despite a quarrel between their masters. And he went on to inquire about the Grand Duke and the state of his health, and to reminiscences of the gay and amusing times he had spent with him in Naples. Then, suddenly, as if remembering his royal dignity, Murat solemnly drew himself up, assumed the pose in which he had stood at his coronation, and waving his right arm said, "I won't detain you longer, General. I wish success to your mission." And with his embroidered red mantle, his flowing feathers, and his glittering ornaments, he rejoined his suite, who were respectfully awaiting him. Balashov rode on, supposing from Murat's words that he would very soon be brought before Napoleon himself. But instead of that, at the next village, the sentinels of Davout's infantry corps detained him, as the pickets of the vanguard had done, and an adjutant of the corps commander who was fetched conducted him into the village to Marshal Davout. Chapter 5 Balashov is at last presented to Napoleon in Vilna. Davout was to Napoleon what Arakcheyev was to Alexander. Though not a coward like Arakcheyev, he was as precise, as cruel, and as unable to express his devotion to his monarch except by cruelty. In the organism of states, such men are necessary, as wolves